All right. Well, welcome to our sixth lecture in the Orthodox Survival Series. Pretty intense topic today. I see that the parish heeded my warning that some of the, not a lot, but a little bit of the material won't be appropriate for young kids. So we have a little bit of a smaller crowd, but still a good attendance. And we'll try to keep it above water as much as possible. This is lecture number six of eight. So we've done a lot, right? I mean, we've covered a lot. It's been kind of like a tidal wave of information, right? It's been pretty darn intense. And it's going to be intense this week and next week, continuing. And then week eight, we'll do something kind of interesting. We're going to take everything that we said and try to wrap it up in 30 minutes, ha ha ha. And then we'll have just an extended question and answer session, which I think will be pretty interesting. Father Justin and I talked about possibly having you maybe email questions in the week ahead of time, just in case some of them take some time to kind of prepare to answer, but also to keep things organized. But we haven't quite decided yet, so we'll let you know. But either way, today we're going to talk about these two major issues, and they're major issues of our times. You know, any other time, and these wouldn't be the major issues. These aren't the things that are at the forefront of culture and society and people's minds. But in our culture today, which is just, it shows you how sick our culture has become, these two things are the things that are probably talked about the most and pushed the most, and that's homosexuality and transgenderism. Two major issues of our days. And if you notice, the main title of today's lecture was something along the lines of a person's identity or something along those lines. Identity is really at the root of this talk and these two issues. And as Orthodox Christians, when we talk about identity, we automatically, without skipping a beat, our mind immediately goes to God. Why? Because we're created by God. You can't talk about identity without talking about the creator of the one who's seeking his identity. We're absolutely connected to God. He's our creator. And therefore, whatever identity we have is one that is God-given. God gives us our identity, our purpose. Everything we have comes from him except for our sin. And this is really the root of the problem, is how do we identify ourselves? More by what God gave us or more by our sin? And this is really the struggle. And you see St. Paul talking a lot about this in his epistles when he talks about the old man. He talks about the old man as if he's a separate person. He says, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. So who died? He still uses the word I and me. So who died when he says it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me? The old man. Who is the old man? He also calls him the man of sin. In other words, we're identified by our sin until we are renewed as new creatures in God. And then we find our true identity, not the distorted one, not the false one. And we spend our lives having those two identities really claw at each other. And we try to feed the true identity and we try to starve the false identity. But when we choose to sin, we end up feeding the false identity and starving the true identity. And this is kind of the back and forth of the Christian life. So we can't truly know ourselves apart from our Creator. And this is why St. Isaac the Syrian has that very famous quote, "He who knows himself is greater than he who can raise the dead by his prayers." It takes a long time to get to know ourselves. It takes a very, very long time. Some people come to me and they say, "Father," well, this happens almost every confession, "Father, I know there's more." "Do you?" "Well, yeah, I know there's more, but I don't know what it is." Good. That's a good statement. It's not good that we don't know what it is, but it's good that you recognize that. And Father Josiah Trenum has a great line in his catechism series where he talks about how the mystery of God is infinite. You could explore the mystery of God for all eternity and never, never plumb the depths of God's mystery. But man is created in the image and likeness of God, which means that the mystery of every human person is equally deep, is equally infinite. So to really get to know ourselves, it means that we have to live greatly ascetic lives, and we have to pray a lot. We have to get to know God, and only then do we really get to know ourselves. It takes a long time. But because this is such a tough prospect, and many of us don't even know that we need to do it, we identify ourselves in other ways. a lot of times we identify ourselves by our desires, which is something we'll talk a lot about today, or what we do. You know, the example I like to give of this is, if I mentioned to you, like, LeBron James, who's LeBron James? The first thing you would say is, a basketball player. And a lot of people would identify him as a basketball player. But if you were to take LeBron James and lock him up in a room where he had no basketball, no hoop, and he wasn't allowed to play, is he still LeBron James? Yeah. So as much as basketball may be a part of his life, the deepest identity there isn't really basketball. There's something more to him. And so we have to discover who we really are as Orthodox Christians. Really, what we see today is people trying to seek a freedom in their identity. They're trying to say that my identity is constrained by nothing, and therefore I get to choose my true identity. It's not about discovering your true identity, it's rather about asserting an identity and believing that any constraints to that are oppressive. This is the modern ideology. So, if you look at me and say, clearly you're a man, I would say, no, I don't identify as a man, and how I identify is the most important thing, and my choice is the most important aspect of my identity, and therefore I refuse to be constrained even by my biological sex. And you may look at this and say, well, this is pretty crazy, because if this is true freedom, that I can identify myself however I want. This, by the way, that this is what deep down transgenderism is about. It's about breaking the last boundaries of identity so that I can completely reform myself to whatever I want to be. I think it's about some other things as well. We'll talk about that. But you follow the logic of this and start to say, well, wait a minute. If you're not bound by your own biology, what else are you not bound by? Are you not bound by your own age? Believe it or not, there are people who believe so. There's a guy in Canada who decides that he is no longer, even though he was a husband and a father, one day he decided, I'm no longer a 40-something-year-old man, I'm actually an 8-year-old girl. And he went and got adopted by a family who had a daughter, and he plays with the daughter all the time. By the way, before he was adopted, he met up with his new foster dad at a hotel, and you can guess what happened there. Sick. It's true. I've listened to interviews about this guy, and I've listened to podcasts where people talk about what a great liberation this is for him. Well, if I'm not bound by my age, if I'm not bound by my biology, then maybe I'm also not bound by my race. Do we see that happening today? Yes, there are people who identify as black even though they're white. Some of them have come out and apologized because that butts up against the other part of the ideology. You see, the ideology is constantly fighting itself, by the way. It's one of the interesting things about today. You know what one of the big fights is about identity? It's between the transgenders and lesbians and feminists. And there's this infighting about, well, wait a minute, are you really women? Are you really this? I mean, you don't have to deal with the things that women have to deal with, and I don't think you should be really considered women, but wait a minute, but identity is everything, and I identify as a woman. And this big, like, fight back and forth. I mean, it's craziness. It's craziness. So the reality is that we've become, oh, by the way, one more. If I'm not bound by my biology, by my age, if I'm not bound by my race, maybe I'm also not bound by my species. And are there rare cases where you can find people who identify as other creatures? Yes. Yes, you can. There's a girl in, I think, Sweden who identified as a cat. I was watching an interview she was doing, and I thought, well, this is strange. I've never seen a cat do an interview. But for some reason, this cat did. She could do interviews and talk about why she identifies as a cat. It's craziness. I mean, obviously, there's something really wrong there, but this is happening. This is happening. So we've become a post-fact, post-truth, and post-reality culture. Because fact, truth, and reality constrain us, and we need to be free, right? This is kind of the idea. We need to be free of everything. So that my choice is the greatest thing, it's the most powerful thing, it is the highest criterion of truth for me. And whatever is my truth, it doesn't matter what your truth is, it doesn't even matter what objective truth is. My truth is the most important thing. So this is kind of the foundation of what we see happening around us. So, before we get to our two topics of homosexuality and transgenderism, a few introductory remarks. And the first major point I want to make to you is this. We look at people saying that something is right because it's the way God created it as a poor and weak argument. When somebody says, well, that's just the way God created it, we look at that as a poor argument. That is wrong. That is the highest argument. God's intent for creation is the highest and most significant argument that we have. It is the most important thing. It's ultimately the only one that matters because it's the only criterion that will be eternal. How God intended things is the most important argument that we have. We can't look at it as simplistic to say this is the way God meant for it to be. It's not simplistic. And the more you plumb the depths of the faith, the more you realize that this is everything for us. Everything is about the way God created it. How rebellious, how ridiculous that the very creatures created by God decide that they have a purpose and a meaning that somehow supersedes God's. He created us, of course. His creation and his purpose, his intention for that creation is the most important thing. We can't override that. And so discovering God's purpose for our life is the most important thing we can do. Thank God in the Orthodox Church we don't have to guess about this. We know what God's intention is for mankind because we know God. Because God reveals himself to mankind. God reveals himself to man in and through Christ. And in and through the continuation of Christ's ministry in the church. That's why we line our walls with the saints. God has revealed himself to them. Why? Because blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. God reveals himself, his purpose, and man's identity to those who are pure in heart, which is why the whole purpose of the Orthodox Church is to gain a pure heart so that God can reveal himself to us as well. You heard me talk about this a few weeks ago in a homily where I said, often we feel like our sin and our passions are closer to us than Christ himself. This shows us that we're not living rightly. When we live rightly, we begin to sense and notice the closeness of God, the closeness of the Theotokos, of the saints, of our angel, far more than we do our sin. And that's when we begin to really understand our own identity. That's where our identity really comes to the forefront. We no longer feel the closeness of our sin more than we feel the closeness of Christ, our Creator. And thus we begin to truly understand ourselves. So when the Orthodox Christian looks at all these things, we look at these issues from a backwards perspective. And I don't mean backwards in the sense that the culture today would call us backwards. I mean in time. We look at things from the moment of judgment back. What I mean by that is we look at things from the perspective of how will this affect eternity? How will this have an impact upon eternity for myself and for those around me? If we know that pushing something, pushing an ideology or an idea in order to make somebody feel good, ultimately results in their condemnation before the throne of God, there's no compassion in that. There's absolutely zero compassion in that. We look at everything from the point of judgment backwards. It doesn't matter how happy or comfortable or welcomed or accepted we make somebody feel. If it leads away from heaven, if we set them facing away from God, we are doing an evil work, no matter how much we call it love. It is a work of evil. Now, on the other hand, of course, we don't try to make people feel uncomfortable for no reason. That's not the goal. But whatever we do, as we seek to do it with humility and love, we also do it with truth. Love without truth is not love. Just as truth without love is counterproductive and harmful. Truth without love is that ideology that we were talking about. It's becoming an ideological Christian. But love without truth is evil. Is evil. It's not really love. It's a counterfeit form of love, and we see that all around us. That brings us to our second major introductory point. The world does not know what love is. The world does not understand love anymore because love can never be separated from God. Again, once you separate love from truth, and truth for us is a person, is Jesus Christ. Once you separate love from him, and you use that to separate the person further from Christ, this is no longer true love. It's a counterfeit, and it's what the world is pushing today. There was a study that came out quite a few years ago showing that children who grow up with same-sex parents are just as, quote-unquote, well-adjusted as kids who grow up with opposite-sex parents. First of all, that study, I'd love to know what they mean by well-adjusted. But the reality is nobody is well-adjusted apart from God. Do you know what the fathers say about mental illness, by the way? They say, yes, there are people who have mental illnesses, chemical imbalances in the brain, but if we understand things properly, anybody who is not a saint is mentally ill. Every single one of us is mentally ill because we do not see through the eyes of Christ. We don't have the minds of Christ. And until we gain that, we don't see things properly. So mental illness does is it causes you to see things in a skewed way. We all see things in a skewed way. So by making somebody comfortable with their illness, there's no love in that. There's no love. It doesn't matter how well adjusted it looks to society. Society itself is sick. It's one of the big criticisms I have, by the way, of modern counseling and psychology. A lot of times you have psychologists whose lives are just completely messed up. And so they're supposed to bring you to mental health. But their idea of what mental health is based on their own experiences. And their own experiences are nuts. Which is a good technical term. Nuts. If this is their gauge of normality, of normalcy, then how are they going to help somebody else? Mental health really has no objective standard for what health, mental health is. This is the problem. That's why we need faith. And finally, the third point, you're going to see a lot of this today. Sorry, it's not the final one. Three out of four. He who controls the language controls the argument. Our society is constantly changing the language of this debate, of the terms of homosexuality and transgenderism and marriage. We're going to see a lot of that. And if you control the language, you can control how things are perceived by people and the emotional response they have to them. Language is a huge part of these issues. So redefining words can have severe consequences. You're going to see a lot of this tonight. You're going to see how redefining terms can change the way we look at things and thus the way we talk about them. And that's the whole worldview behind them. You shape people's worldviews by changing and controlling language. And finally now, the fourth point. We need courage in talking about these things. To live and stand firmly for and in God rather than being pleasing to the world. The word courage has been bastardized today. It's one of those words that has been changed. Courage today is when you toe the ideological line of our times and everyone around you applauds and tells you how great and wonderful you are. How is that courageous to have everybody applauding you? You guys remember when Bruce Jenner got the ESPY award? Do you remember the controversy that happened? As he was applauded, everyone's clapping, and Brett Favre was in the audience. And Brett Favre clapped, but not very enthusiastically. And he was slammed on the media, online for it. He was absolutely slammed for not being enthusiastic enough in his clapping. But everyone said Bruce Jenner was the one who had such courage to receive this award. Is it courageous for the whole society to reward you and then yell at people who don't clap enthusiastically enough for you? Is that really courage? No. No, we need true courage. What does the word holy mean? You know what holy means? Somebody must know. What does holy mean?
Set apart.
Set apart. We are set apart from this fallen world. We have to be set apart from this modern ideology and our culture today in standing against these ideological trends. This is what it means to be holy. Not to have everybody around you applauding you. It often means to be martyred. And if we're not martyred in body, we will be martyred publicly. On social media, online, in the media, whatever it is. We'll be martyred in that sense. What does St. Anthony say? Father Justin quoted this one. In the last days, insane people will walk the streets, and when they see one sane person, they'll look at him and say, "You're crazy. You're not like us." Is that today? Big time. That is today. So, let's get on to this issue of homosexuality. We're going to see if we can do both of these issues in 20 minutes. each. I don't know how well that's going to go, but we're going to try. Keep in mind, by the way, I had a whole series of lectures for, it was canceled because of COVID, or at least pushed back, but I had a 3-lecture series, over 3 hours of material, just in the issue of transgenderism alone. So trying to pack these down is tough, but we're going to do our best. So homosexuality. First, we need to talk about worldviews, okay? We've been talking a lot about worldviews, obviously, the past few weeks. Today we talked about how identity is mixed with desire, right? So there's no sense of a need to purify our desires. We're going to end with that, by the way, because there's a really sick desire that we're told is normal today. Pedophilia. That's being normalized today. So you don't need to purify your desires. There's no such thing as having corrupt desires. Whatever you desire is the most important thing. That's who you are. It's unloving to question or challenge someone's desires. Why? Because desire is identity, like we talked about. What I desire is my idea. That's who I am. So if you criticize my desire, that's to, you hear this word all the time, dehumanize me. That's to dehumanize me. You don't view me as a person anymore. This is wrapped up with the political worldview we've been discussing, right? It's wrapped up in another way. The true goals of the LGBT movement are rarely revealed openly. They always go in stages. And we've seen that, right? 20, 30 years ago, what was the call in the homosexual community? We needed what? Tolerance. That's all we want. We don't need your acceptance. We just need tolerance. When I was in elementary school, we were actually told that. When speakers come and talk to us, and they say, well, we're not even asking for acceptance. You don't have to accept us. We just want tolerance. Well, then tolerance became, no, we need your acceptance. We're not asking for marriage. We're not trying to take marriage from you. We just want acceptance. Then it became, well, of course, we want marriage. We want marriage. Every now and then, though, you get somebody who tells you what they really want. There is an activist, a lesbian activist named Masha Gessen. She was speaking to a group of LGBT activists one day. And she said, of course we believe that we need gay marriage. That's a no-brainer. But that's not the real goal. You know what she said the real goal was? We want to destroy the idea of marriage altogether. We think the institution of marriage shouldn't exist. What do you think her audience did when she said that? They cheered big time. Every now and then you get a little glimpse into what the true goal is. The destruction of marriage was the goal. You see also with the worldview behind this, there's an obsession with lewd and unrestrained sex. Father Josiah gave a speech. He's like a national hero in the country of Georgia because of this talk he gave. You can listen to it online. And I think that was the one where he says that if you look at these pride parades, they're basically mass celebrations with worshipers of the phallic symbol. That's what we see. There's an obsession. By the way, you notice when they have the pride event just a block away from here, I have to tell my kids, keep your heads down as we drive by. Do you notice the imagery you see all around? Do you know what imagery it is? Religious imagery. People love to put on angels' wings. You notice that? So there is a religious worship of the phallic symbol and of unrestrained passions and sex. But deeper down, there's a part that they won't talk about. Deeper down, you know what there is? There's a fear of purity. There's a fear. Why? Because purity, the existence of purity around them, this is why the goal isn't just to live the way they want to live, but rather to change culture around you. Because purity exposes you. It exposes you. It exposes the true self and the image of God within, which is still there. The image of God is there, but we don't want to have to see it. Father Justin mentioned, by the way, he walked by one night with some people. They were going to a restaurant. He walked by, and he said as they were having the celebration, he said every now and then somebody would look up and see him, dressed as a priest, cassock, cross, and everything, and there was a look of shame. And they'd put their heads down ashamed. So they want to avoid that, so what do? They try to abolish it altogether, get rid of that. Get rid of any symbols of purity. Now, I can assert this because I read a really incredible article once from this ex-gay rights leader. And you know what he talked about was at the center. He started a gay rights magazine. He led all these parades. He said at the center of everything was self-hatred. That's what was behind all their push. And so in order to get rid of the self-hatred, they decided to mask it with anger. Anger, especially at Christians, was a necessary distraction. In other words, blame others so I don't have to look at myself. He said that was at the center of the movement. Later, he repented of this, became a Christian, and taught to live a life of purity. He said he'd never been happier. But he said at the root of the movement was that. Anger at anybody who preaches purity so that we can be distracted by how much we hate ourselves. Sad. So what's our perspective? Well, we lose our purpose, or when we lose our purpose in God, everything becomes permissible, right? If God is dead, everything is permissible. So when we lose our purpose in God, that's the same as killing off God himself. Defining what is right and loving outside of God is impossible. It's impossible. One of the things I like to do is I like to watch debates between Christians and atheists. You've heard me probably talk about this before. A lot of times, though, the Christians are evangelicals, and their perspective on God is so skewed, I end up agreeing more with the atheist than the evangelical. But there was one that was really interesting where somebody started talking about, I think it was Christopher Hitchens, who's a very interesting thinker, even though he's very wrong on a lot of these issues. I think it was him who was talking about how many things from Christianity are just plain wrong. And so his interlocutor was asking, he said, you keep saying wrong and evil. What is wrong and evil? Can you objectively define wrong and evil? Because without God, there is no objective definition of these things, which means you can't say something is wrong or evil because you have no objective rule or standard for what you call good and bad, or holy and evil, or righteous and unrighteous. How can you define those things without any objective standard? And he couldn't answer. He just went back with, well, it's evil when you guys do this and this and this and this. And he goes, wait. Define for me evil, objectively. Throughout all history, throughout all cultures, what is evil? Well, that changes through history and cultures. This is why we need a God. The reality is that man has within him a deep yearning for truth, for beauty, and for love. And this cannot be fulfilled outside of God. Period. It cannot be fulfilled outside of God. Which is why there's an underlying malaise in the LGBT lifestyle. I don't know if you've noticed that, but when you talk to people who are really involved in this movement, and I've talked to many who have left the movement, they'll tell you, underneath it all, again, they hate themselves. There's this underlying malaise and depression and fear and anxiety that they can't get rid of. And you try to put all these band-aids on it and get all these distractions, but nothing seems to work. There's another belief that we have as Orthodox Christians that's really important to understand, and that's that sin is never just private. What's the proof of that? What's the proof that sin is not just a private matter? There's a scriptural proof for this. Go earlier. Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve do one thing wrong. They disobey one commandment. Are they the only beings that fell from God's grace? No. All of creation around them. The whole physical world, all animals. Suddenly, plants could have thorns that could hurt them. Animals could bite. Paradise was gone. Was gone. That great quote from St. Seraphim of Sarov, acquire the spirit of peace and thousands around you will be saved. Just as grace floods out and transfigures the world around us, so sin can conversely be destructive. When I sin, it doesn't just affect me, it affects my relationship with every single one of you. It affects the whole world around us. The more sin abounds, the more people get sucked into more sin. Sin becomes normalized. The passions and temptations become multiplied, and suddenly people are sucked more and more into them. So we have to understand that when we look at the movement of homosexuality around us, this is not just the cause of greater sin around us, it's also the result of us already having departed from God. Romans 1 talks about this, right? Romans 1, 24 and 25. Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. God gave them up to these things because they had already departed from true worship. True worship heals, false worship corrupts. We have been falling away from proper worship for a long time. When we look at the homosexual movement around us, we can't just condemn it. We also have to condemn ourselves. This is our faults. We haven't remained connected to God. We haven't worshipped as we should. We departed from God so long ago in this country. And therefore, God gave us up. It's both a cause and a result. So let's talk about some of the typical arguments you get when talking about homosexuality. Typical arguments you might hear around you. First, and we'll use, by the way, both arguments based in faith and what we might call secular arguments. It's important to have both. It's important to have both, but we're gonna end with a point that's really important, but I'm gonna leave it to the end because it undergirds everything we're gonna say. So first, of course, you hear people say, well, how could you condemn somebody for having same-sex attraction when they were born this way, right? You're born this way. Have you noticed, by the way, that argument is not used very much anymore? It's not used very much anymore because now they say, well, sexuality is fluid. In other words, it's in admitting that a lot of people just choose it. But this is one of those areas. Do you remember when we were talking about how people really don't know logical fallacies and how to use logic, and I gave you some examples to watch out for. One of them was false dilemmas or false options. A lot of times people will say, well, it's either a choice or you're born that way. Which is it? I've seen a lot of different examples. I've seen a lot of different things. I've seen people who believe they were born that way. They felt like they had those attractions right at the beginning. I saw people who, after abuse, that's when they started to have same-sex attraction. They had, you know, for instance, some of them, it was dealing with neglect. I know somebody who had no relationship with her mother whatsoever. She had no good relationship. She only had a good relationship with her father. And with the men in her lives, she started to have a very, very negative view of women. And so she started to identify more as a boy, and therefore felt that the only way that she could please or redeem women in her life was to find a woman herself. She realized that after some psychology later on. There are some people who just openly choose the lifestyle. I'll tell you a really sick example of this is there was somebody who was living as a transgender, but he really appeared to be a woman. So he'd beat guys in clubs. He'd take them home. And in the middle of the night, they would discover, whoa, he had no bottom surgery, is what they call it. So they discover that it was a man. And you know what he said? He said, you have no idea how many guys I've converted. You have no idea how many guys I've converted. Pretty sick. Some people say it's genetic. This has not been proven, but even if we believe that there may be a genetic tendency towards alcoholism. It's not like genes are the one thing that were preserved in the fall. No, genes can be fallen too. There are a lot of different reasons that people could have these attractions. So it's not as simple, you're born that way or you choose it. There's a lot of different things that can happen. I've read a lot of articles about women who felt that men had betrayed them and abused them so much in their lives, they decided just to give up on men and go for women instead. They felt men were not reliable. So there are a lot of different things that could be happening. One of the arguments you hear all the time is, well, it's just two consenting adults. If it's two consenting adults, who are you to say anything about it? Here's the problem with this argument. This argument means that the only sexual value that we listen to is consent. It's the only value that we're going to hold ourselves up to. Is that really the society we want to live in, where consent is the highest and only value that we really care about? That is a dangerous thing. And by the way, we talked about how the slippery slope argument is not really a fallacy. This is a slippery slope moment. When consent becomes the only thing, guess what starts to happen to society? You can view others with a lot less respect. All I need is your consent, and after that, I really don't care what I do with you. You're just a sexual object to me. We ruin our own dignity in this way, because my consent is the only thing that matters to the other person, too. Even, by the way, Hollywood instinctively knows, or at least they used to know, that this was a big problem. Because you used to have on television shows, there was always the comedic character who used to sleep around like crazy, like on Friends it was Joey or something like that. And always like 4 or 5 seasons in, that character would have this self-realization that I want something deeper in my life. This is all meaningless. I really need a deeper meaning. Well, all they had before was the value of consent. It was the only important thing. And suddenly they realized there's deeper meaning. Even Hollywood deep down knows consent can't be the only value that we have. Of course, you get the argument all the time. Love is love. How can you deny people love? Love is love. So, largely connected to the last point that consent and desire are the only important things. You know what this really fails to recognize, though? It fails to recognize that marriage is different from other relationships. Why should we believe in same-sex marriage? Well, because love is love. We should just believe in love altogether, blah, 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 blah. Well, wait a minute. Is marriage any different from any other relationship I have? There's an author and a philosopher named Ryan Anderson. We're going to talk about him a little bit later tonight, a couple of the books that he's written. I really recommend, by the way, if you look up some YouTube videos, you can watch him talking about marriage. He wrote actually he co-authored a book called What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense? But then he wrote kind of a simpler version. That one's very, very philosophical. Then he wrote a simpler version. I'll tell you the name of that later. But he gives summaries of this book and talks. I went to a series of lectures by him in 3 hours. It took him 3 hours to go through the whole argument. It was a pretty deep argument. Three hours, but it was so powerful. And by the way, he was a really great guy. I talked to him a little bit. I really came to respect him and the way he approaches things. But he basically says, like, even though he's a religious person, I think he's Catholic, he says, well, those arguments aren't going to work for most people. I think they're still important. I'll tell you why at the end. But he says, if we're going to use secular arguments, there's a really good secular argument for why marriage is between a man and a woman. And I'm going to give you just some bullet points about his talk. Again, look on YouTube. You can find an hour-long version of his talk, or you can find the 3-hour version, but the hour-long one is worthwhile listening to. And this is what he says. He says, marriage is not just a different degree of love, but is a different type of relationship altogether. If it's just a different degree of love, then what happens is I have like my best friend, or I like my friends next to me, but the ones that I'm best friends with, that's just a different degree. I love him more than anyone, so why don't I just get married to him? Well, no, because that's not a marriage. There's a different type of relationship altogether. And so, what makes marriage different are 4 things. This is why it's not just a different degree, it's a different type of relationship. Number one, it unites complementary beings. A man and a woman are complementary in a way that only one man and one man can be, one man and one woman can be united. Only in marriage do you get this type of relationship. Obviously, you can get outside of a relationship, but not without the other 3 points. In marriage, there's a complementary relationship, a man and a woman who can unite in a way that only one man and one woman can. Number 2, this union has the potential to create life. Now, in some cases, we know that people have fertility issues and it doesn't. But we don't use that exception to get rid of the rule. The potential is for this union to create life. Number 3, in marriage, that relationship is exclusive. My friendship, doesn't matter if I have a best friend, it's not an exclusive relationship. I'm allowed to have other friends. No friendship ends because somebody finds out that his friend also has other friends, you know. But marriages end all the time when you find out that your husband or your wife has somebody else on the side who they're acting like husband or wife with. Okay? So, unites complementary beings, has the potential to create life, is exclusive, and finally, number 4, and this, by the way, is why I say this is our fault. Why has God given us up to this? Because marriage, if proper, is supposed to be permanent. You can gain and lose friends all you want in your life, and there's really no major effect on society. But marriage is intended to be permanent. And for these 4 reasons, and this is the only reason that the state ever got involved with marriage to begin with. There's a big argument today that the state should never be involved with marriage. I don't mind the state being involved with marriage if they understand what marriage is. If marriage is just one more extreme emotional bond than another, it's just a different degree of relationship, not a different type, the state wouldn't need to get involved at all. But because it's a different type, and because life is created, the state has an invested interest in keeping marriages exclusive and permanent. Because the less they become exclusive and permanent, and you have children, guess what? This is a cost to society. We see that, right? We see that when families are broken up, society gets part of the cost. So the only reason the state is involved is because of these four points. And it's what makes marriage a different thing altogether. To make life, we need complementary aspects of a man and a woman. So think about yourself individually. You have a nervous system that is full and complete. You have a digestive system that is full and complete. The only system that you have that is not full and complete is your reproductive system. A man needs a woman, and a woman needs a man. And this is why marital union isn't just a love-making act, it is a life-making act. It creates a life that, in 9 months, requires a name. Only marriage does that. Because these complementary things can create life, it's very important that those two stay together, it's exclusive, and it's important that it remains permanent. That's why the state's involved. That's the secular argument. There's a much fuller argument to this. And I'd recommend finding those talks. But if you want the kind of simplified version of this, it's in this book. It's called Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, again by Ryan Anderson. I highly recommend this one. If you want a much more philosophical approach to it, he co-authored a book called What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense. But this is kind of the executive summary. That's a little bit easier to digest. It's not quite as dense. I highly, highly recommend this book. Okay. So, when we discuss these issues, what should be our disposition? Okay. What are the cans and can'ts of this discussion? Number one, we have strong beliefs about this, but we don't need to be aggressors. What I mean by that is we don't go looking for these fights. We don't need to point out every time somebody says something in favor of homosexuality or gay marriage, we don't need to sit there and step up every time. A lot of times it's just not worthwhile. There's really no point in doing it. A good approach, if you are going to talk about these things, is first seek some common ground. And this means educating people. And for instance, those four points. Dr. Anderson told us that he gave this talk at a university, and he had some students come up to him afterwards and say, I can't think of a single argument. I'm completely in favor of gay marriage, but I can't think of a single argument to go against what you said. Everything you said is true. I'm not on board with it, but I can't tell you why it's wrong, and I think you probably are right. It's pretty interesting. He found some common ground with them, and that was a good way to plant some seeds. But when we do talk, we need to be bold. We need boldness on these topics. And again, it's perfectly okay to say, this is how God created things. Again, we're going to talk about that at the very end today. We need to be wise. We need to know who we're talking to, whether it's worthwhile, and how we talk to them is really important. Which means we need to be at peace. If you find that your passions are being inflamed as you talk about this, you're not in a good state to talk about these things. I was talking to somebody earlier about, after I said don't have these discussions on Facebook, I had a couple of these discussions on Facebook, mainly about abortion. But I was telling somebody, I was actually just trying kind of this experiment. I came up with some different ways of framing arguments. I wanted to see how people would react. Well, one person just deleted their post altogether and refused to engage with me, and the other person just kept arguing and basically ignoring what I was saying and told me that my arguments were invalid and all this different. It was what I expected, but I was curious. It was a curious thing. But this person told me, well, I was getting really angry, and that's probably not the best way to do it. That's right. Don't be a keyboard warrior. You can't do it that way. You have to be at peace, and you have to love the person sitting across from you even as you discuss these things. But ultimately, you have to remember, even though you have somebody across from you who disagrees with you, this is not about two equal but different opinions. It is not about equal opinions. It is about truth and falsehood. And it's about a falsehood that can kill. That can separate a person from God for all eternity. This is why we need boldness. Loving boldness indeed. We need humble boldness, but we do need boldness. This is why it's good to read things like Ryan Anderson's book, because we should be educated on these topics. I told you before, a lot of the books I recommend, you don't need to read. This is one I would say I really highly recommend that you read this one. Even if you don't read the other ones that I've recommended, this one I would say is really good to read. Because we need to be prepared to have these discussions. So, we talked about being holy, being set apart. We are set apart on these issues. But we stand proudly before God, not cowardly before men. Don't be cowards. Do not be cowards on these topics. Don't sit there and cower away and be scared to raise up a voice. No, we need Christians who can boldly proclaim truth. Okay. I have 15 minutes. Can I do the transgender part in 15 minutes? We're going to find out. Okay. Transgenderism, I told you that when you control the vocabulary, you control the argument. Because you put things in people's minds that aren't necessarily true. Right? So, what are some of the terms you need to know? Just a couple of them. I think you need to know if you're going to talk about these things. You hear the word cisgender go around a lot. Cisgender. Cisgender, C-I-S, gender is what it is basically that you identify, again, this is the language, you identify with the gender that you were assigned at birth. This is how they define cisgender. If you're cisgender, and by the way, the worst thing in the world to be, I'm sorry, there's quite a few of you in here, I'm going to tell you how horrible you are right now. If you are a cisgender white male, you're the scum of the earth. We've talked about why in past lectures. And by the way, if you're a cisgender white male Christian, then you're even worse. You're even worse. Yeah, high fives all around. If you're going to go low, go the lowest. Cisgender, I identify, this is the very definition contains all this language that we would have just said, you're male or female, that's just what you are, that's all there is to it. No. Cisgender, you identify, there's a word, as the gender, a word that they changed, we'll talk about that. You identify as the gender you were assigned, not that you were born with, but assigned at birth. So these are some other ones you'll hear. Sex, gender identity, gender expression, and attraction. All of these things can be completely different. They came up with this thing called the genderbread man, which was to describe these different ideas to children. They had to change it. Guess why? Why did they have to change it? That's patriarchal. It's called the genderbread man. You can't do that. So now they have the gender unicorn. Not even joking. I'm not even joking. You can look it up. It's called the gender unicorn. And it points to different parts of the body, okay? And so, biological sex, that's when you point right to the waist area. Biological sex is basically what equipment were you born with. Gender identity, that's where they point to the head. This is how you identify yourself, because I may not identify myself according to my biology. So this is where they changed. Sex and gender used to be the same thing. In fact, those used to be just grammatical differences. That's all. You just use them differently with grammar. Not anymore. Now they have different meanings. Sex and gender are two different things now. Then you have gender expression. This is the whole body. My gender identity may be male or female or two-spirit. That's one. Or gender fluid, which means I can change every single day. Or I mean, there's like 72 of them. I'm not going to go through all of them. But my gender expression is how I may look on the outside. So I may look more masculine, more feminine, or I may look like neither. I may look somewhere in between. There's all these different things. And then finally, there's attraction, which they point to the heart. And this is who I'm attracted to. I may be attracted to somebody who's a straight male or a straight female, or maybe somebody who's bi, or maybe somebody who, you know, I'm two-spirit, so I want somebody else who's two-spirit. And, I mean, it gets really, really crazy. And again, the reason it keeps changing, when you ask, like, how many gender identities are there, you know what they'll tell you? Infinite. Because you can create your own. Why? Because we can't even be constrained by 72 definitions. That's still too limiting. We need this full freedom to be able to describe ourselves however we are. Okay, so those are some of the important terms you need to know. I want to run through.
I have a question. So when people claim to be on different ends of all that, in other words, they can have be pulled in four different directions based on their heart, mind, business, all that stuff, can be totally different. Right.
Yeah, so the question is basically, is it possible for somebody to have no uniformity between those four things? And yes, that's absolutely possible. You can have a sex that is one thing, a gender identity that's another thing, a gender expression that's a completely different thing, and an attraction that's not related to any of those.
And what trumps it to them? Is it one that takes the lead to them and the highest?
No, I don't think there's one that trumps the other. I mean, the only thing that really doesn't matter is biology. Biology almost doesn't matter at all. Everything else, though, is up to choice. So really the human will, the depraved human will, is the highest criterion. And you can decide these things, and you can change. So much so that you don't even want to use regular pronouns. Not just like, I want to be a she and a her. Rather, I could be a ze and a zer, or I could be a them and a they. You can make up terms, literally. You can literally make up terms and then force other people to use them and say that you're oppressing me if you don't use them. That's how crazy it is. It's just insane. So I want to talk about some historical figures in the whole transgender movement. And I'm going to tell you right now, get ready to be shocked. I'll tell you what I was going to do for my original three-part lecture. The first lecture was all going to be about transgender history. And I was going to give the history twice. The first history I was going to give was going to be very short, and I was going to describe history on their own terms. How transgenderism came to be a thing and how it developed, both scientifically and culturally and everything. And then the second time I was going to run through the exact same thing, but I was going to fill in all the stuff that they didn't tell you. The stuff they left out purposely. I'm going to tell you just a few things. This is a very, very small amount of what I was going to include in that first lecture. So the first person who was really a great pioneer for them was Alfred Kinsey. Now, I can tell a lot of you don't necessarily know who he is, because usually if people know who he is, they go, ugh. If you're not part of this current ideology. Because today, if you're part of the current ideology, he is glorified. He's glorified so much they have museums in his honor, and they made a movie about him. Anybody know who that movie starred? Liam Neeson. You haven't seen it, have you? Oh, thank God. I couldn't get through. Oh, it was awful. They glorified him in Hollywood. He was the pioneer of what they call sexology. He pioneered two massive studies on the sexual habits of the American male and the American female. Here's something they don't tell you about it. Both studies were a complete fraud. When he studied males, do you know who his main sample size came from? He wouldn't tell you this at the time. The prison population. Do you think that prisoners who were in jail for sexual crimes would be a good representative of the average American male? Didn't matter to him. It was very poorly done. When they couldn't get answers to the people, sometimes they'd just make them up. It was intentionally skewed to make people look more sexually permissive than they actually were. Homosexuality and sexuality were looked to be on a spectrum. So it really pushed this idea that straight males were actually out with other males all the time, and that was a really normal thing, and we just didn't talk about it as a society. So he was trying to actually change culture with this. By the way, he had an open marriage with his wife. He would be with men and women who were outside of the marriage. She would be with men and women. They would film these things. And one of the most horrific things that they don't tell you about, kids, plug your ears. He performed many experiments on children as young as just a couple months old. It's horrific. This guy ought to be derided and spat upon in history. And we have museums in his honor, and made a movie about him. Sick. It's absolutely sick what this man did. He's considered one of the first great pioneers of transgenderism. The next one was a friend of his. And I refuse to call them doctor. Harry Benjamin. Another sick person in history. He was a friend of Kinsey's. There was a little boy who felt more like he was a girl. So Harry Benjamin goes to some of his psychology friends, his psychologists, and asks them if he should start pumping this kid full of female hormones to make it more like a female. Make him more like a female. What do the psychologists recommend? Don't do it. He said, forget it. I'm going to do it anyway. And so he experimented on this child. He ended up becoming a pioneer in this process of hormone therapy. I couldn't find any evidence. I could not find any evidence whatsoever that he followed up with his patients years later to see how it affected them. Experiments on children. Sick. Then there was a French author, philosopher, political activist, social theorist, Simone de Beauvoir. She was an open bisexual. She really first pushed the idea that there's a difference between sex and gender. She first hypothesized that gender is not the same thing as sex, but rather is a social construct. By the way, at the end of her life, near the end, in 1977, she was one person of many to sign a petition to decriminalize pedophilia in France. Again, she's hailed as a great pioneer. Now we get to a really sick one. Again, I refuse to call him doctor. By the way, I've watched plenty of videos where other doctors call this man such a genius, such a pioneer. John Money. John Money decided to take all of this ideology that was being pioneered before him and apply it. There were twin boys who were born, and when both of them were sent to be circumcised, one of them unfortunately had a botched circumcision, and he lost his male anatomy. And so John Money said, well, gender's just a social construct, right? So, let's finish the surgery up. By the way, the surgery is a horrific thing. It lasts for months afterwards, all the different things you have to do. They don't tell you that either. So, he talked to the parents and said, it's very simple. We're going to give this kid some more surgery. We're going to make it look as much like a female as possible, and then you can just raise this other one as a girl. So the one who didn't have the botched surgery, you just raise as a boy. This one you raise as a girl. And when you raise this one as a girl, because gender is just a social construct, it'll actually be a she. And she will go through life not knowing that anything ever happened, and it'll all be fine, because she's going to want to be a girl. And this experiment is still to this day in textbooks absolutely praised throughout academia. They don't tell you the rest of the story. The rest of the story is that in order to reinforce, again, kids, cover your ears, in order to reinforce the gender roles, Dr. John Money had the children assume sexual positions and perform sexual acts on one another so that the male could feel more like a male and the so-called female could feel more like a so-called female. Then, by the way, he took pictures of all of this. Textbooks leave that out. They also leave out what happened later. During his teenage years, the one who was being raised like a girl knew something was wrong and went into a deep depression, and his parents finally told him what happened. And so at the age of 15, he began living like a boy again. But the damage was done. After drug abuse and mental illnesses, but to both of these things, there's a clear connection to what happened to them when they were young. At different times, both of these boys committed suicide. John Money, pioneer of transgenderism, hailed in textbooks today. Sick. Now I'll tell you about the one good one, Dr. John McHugh. Dr. John McHugh was at Johns Hopkins University. He actually did something that, lo and behold, a good doctor and scientist would do. He saw all these transgender surgeries being performed and decided to actually follow up with the patients post-surgery. What did he discover? He discovered that most of them, almost every single one of them, before they had surgery, had something called comorbidities. Comorbidity means that they had other mental illnesses that went along with their what they called gender dysphoria. That term has changed multiple times. We'll just call it gender dysphoria. They had anxieties, depressions, and all these different things going on. And what he discovered was they all had the hope that after their surgeries, after a man supposedly, quote-unquote, became a woman or vice versa, that all of these other things would just go away. Depression would go away. Anxiety would go away. And what did he discover? None of that was true. Years later, they were still living in the same misery they had before, and now they looked at their bodies and they looked at themselves as mutilated. And a lot of times it got worse. And guess what happened to many of them? Suicide became the option. The suicide rate was horrifically high. It was horrifically high before surgery, but it remained the same afterwards. So Dr. John McHugh shut down the transgender surgery department and the, I forget what the department was called, at Johns Hopkins University. He shut it down. Good on him. In 2007, however, they reinstated the practice against his strong objections. Scientifically, what had they learned that made them change their mind about it? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It was ideological. It was purely ideological. And he, Dr. John McHugh, has been slandered throughout all of their professional literature. The last major thing he did was just a few years ago. He just did a study of all the different studies that have been done on this topic to show what the results were. And the result, I mean, he wasn't even pushing the conclusion. He was just saying the studies show that this is actually not a very effective thing. In the vast majority of cases, this is not the right way to go. He's been slammed all over for it. They hate him. He's seen as Satan to them. I've watched videos of pro-transgender activists talk about him, and they just spew hatred. Dr. John McHugh is the one they hate. All the other ones they love. So, what's the ideology behind all of this? I knew I couldn't do this in 15 minutes. It's just too much. Keep in mind that none of the push, like I said, was based on science. The push for transgenderism was based on unsubstantiated theories, on failed experiments, and very, very perverse people who practiced and studied sexual immorality and wanted to make sexual immorality the norm. By the way, those who worked with Alfred Kinsey openly stated that that was one of his open goals with them, that he wanted the freaks. He wanted to destroy marriage as we know it. That was his goal. He wanted sexual immorality to be the norm. We know that. One more name, Judith Butler. In the 1990s, she took all of this that was happening and she really pushed the idea. I mean, in a way, she's kind of the founder of this idea of the study of gender theory. And she openly states that sex and gender are different, and she calls gender performative. It's just how you present yourself. That's all gender is, and therefore you can choose what you are. But this is all full of contradictions, by the way. We could spend a lot of time just talking about the contradictions of their ideology. For instance, you know, if a woman feels male, that's accepted, but they also tell you that being male is just a social construct. It doesn't actually exist. So how can you feel something that's not real? But they don't talk about that. The ideology doesn't care. It just cares about pushing the agenda, and they're going to do it with whatever they can. So what are the results of all this? The results are the suicidality rate, as we talked about, is enormous. It's like 16 times, I think, the normal population. Was it? 40%. Yeah, yeah. 40% is the most typical number. Given sometimes it's a little bit higher, sometimes it's a little bit lower. A lot of times, though, what they'll do is they'll show you opposing studies that show that the suicidality rate goes way down post-surgery. The problem is you have to look into those studies. And when you look into them, what do you find? They're a bunch of baloney. A lot of times, it's based... This is how terrible this is. They know that people are committing suicide. They know that children and teenagers are committing suicide. And so they push these false studies that are based on questionnaires. Questionnaires are not a good way to study these things. They push these studies based on questionnaires that are only 1 year apart, from right before the surgery to 1 year afterwards. A lot of times the suicidality doesn't happen until 5, 10, 15 years afterwards, because that's when all those comorbidities start to show themselves again. The excitement is gone. And a lot of people drop out of these studies and they just don't include them. So they might look at, you know, 40 people, and then like 25 of them drop out. And they consider this a legitimate study. The studies showing that this is successful are horrifically bad science, but they push them anyway. The comorbidities continue to maintain. And so we're seeing a huge rise, which they will not tell you about, they don't talk about, and they won't tell parents about it when kids think they're transgender. We're seeing a huge rise in detransitioners. People who have transitioned from one sex to the other and decide to go back because they realize this has not fixed my life, it's made it worse. And when somebody detransitions, they are blacklisted on social media. In fact, one of the main vocal people pushing this is a gentleman who has been recently banned from YouTube because he spoke against child transgenderism. Sick. It's sick. They literally don't want people to know that your kid may commit suicide after this. This is how evil this is. So what are the social results? Well, again, they're silencing people. There's an active movement, an active goal of silencing critics. Even those who went under the transition themselves and detransitioned, and will tell you from firsthand experience how terrible it is. More deaths. Because they're actually encouraging people to believe that they're transgender, and not telling them that they may one day wake up and feel like they've mutilated their body and become even more depressed. But because this is so praised, remember, bravery is to be praised by all society around you. And so what's happened to the youth? There's a great physician who set the term rapid onset gender dysphoria. What is rapid onset gender dysphoria? A teenager is looking online saying, why am I so miserable? Because every teenager today is miserable, basically, if you are wrapped up in the culture around us. But I feel really miserable. Sometimes I'm depressed. And then they see a video of somebody who is transgender and everyone praising them. And in the comments, they see everyone saying, good for you. You're wonderful. You're such an inspiration. And they go, huh, well, maybe I'm miserable because I was born in the wrong body. I'm transgender. And from one minute to the next, they decide they're transgender. This is happening all around us. More and more kids are deciding that they're transgender. There's child confusion. There's kids who are just plain confused about this. And part of the reason they're confused is because if you are in school and you are a cisgender white male or female and you're straight and not homosexual or bi, you're looked down upon. You're literally... I had kids at camp last year tell me that they are made fun of if they don't identify as something unique and special. They're boring and they're ignored. So there's a lot of confusion about this. There's also greater sexual promiscuity. I don't know how much greater it can get than it is now, but we're seeing it. Why? Because you identify yourself by your attractions. And so I need to live who I am, and who I am is sleeping around. And as we said, how far does this go? Can you pick your age? Can you pick your race? Well, people are doing it. People are doing it. It's an interesting video where this guy goes on a college campus and asks, do you think gender dysphoria is okay? I mean, do you think transgenderism is okay? They're like, yeah. If a man wants to, says he's really a woman, that's fine. And he goes, well, what if you know, this guy's like 5 foot something. He goes, what if I identify as like 6'10"? And you see him get this, like, there's like cognitive dissonance, and they get really like uncomfortable. Like, I guess that's okay, because it's not hurting anybody. Yeah, you can do that. Okay, well, what if I identify as Asian? Good for you. So you're telling me, as a 5'7" white male, I can identify as a 6'10" Asian female, and you're okay with that? And like the one that they get uncomfortable with is age. He goes, "What if I identify as 82?" And they're like, "Well, you can't do that." So, wait a minute. Where's the line on this? It's just whatever we think is okay for the time being. So we've lost all sense of reality. We've destroyed reality with all of this. The most horrific part of this, though, is that there's a focus on children. There's a huge focus on children. And by the way, I told you that the whole idea behind this transgenderism and everything happening is that we want to be able to identify ourselves. It's about freedom. I think there's another pernicious thing happening. And I think it's this. If I have the freedom to identify as whatever I'd like, and even as a younger age, then when is that available to me? As soon as I'm conscious. And therefore, children, I think there's a way, there's a sneaky way of trying to get children more involved in this. And that's why we're seeing the rise in this love for pedophilia. By the way, with children, when a little boy says, I think I'm a girl, to a doctor, the doctor will send them to a psychologist. In some cases, one session. One session, and the psychologist signs off on hormone therapy. One session. It's not science. It's not even true psychology. That's ideological. There's experimentation being done on children. This hormone replacement therapy is experimentation. You want to know how I know that? Because I talked to one of the top endocrinologists in the country. And he said that he and most of his colleagues absolutely believe this is abuse. They would never sign off on this. And they try their best not to ever do it, although the laws in many ways force them. But most of his fellow doctors refuse to say so because they're afraid of being canceled. They're afraid of the mob mentality going right after them. They'll tell you, we don't know the results. We don't know the long term. This has never been studied. In Great Britain, by the way, there's one institute that was really pushing this. Most of their doctors resigned in protest. You never heard about that. You never heard about that. Because that doesn't push the party line. It's experimentation on children. This is being pushed so much so that I recently threw away my Barnes & Noble membership card. And I did it right in front of the worker who laughed at me. Because I was at Barnes & Noble, and it was Pride Month. And in the children's section, they have a big display with all the Pride books. One of which pushed drag queens, child drag queens, and celebrated the fact that they were child drag queens. I told him how disgusted I was with that. Again, she smirked. You have the show I Am Jazz, which again is celebrating this thing. This is a boy who believes he's a girl and has gone through all these surgeries, and everyone's talking about how wonderful they give this kid a show. Everyone talks about how great this is and how anybody who disagrees is committing violence against you and is horrific, and we should just shut them down. Then you have, again, you own the terminology and you own everything. It's not pedophiles anymore. They're called MAPS. Minor Attracted Peoples. And you're just born with that. You can't choose it. You're just born with an attraction towards minor. And I'm not even saying to act on it. Because again, we go in steps. I just want you to accept that this is just what I have. Trevor Noah, the host of The Daily Show, he came out recently against... Do you know what did he come out recently against? You know? Gender reveal parties. You know when you're having a baby and you this big party where you... It's a boy, it's a girl. He says, no, that's dangerous. Because you can't decide what gender that child is. A child has to grow up and decide for him or herself, or itself, or theirself, what gender it is. So how do we respond to this as Orthodox Christians? Well, first of all, the proof of this movement and the sickness of this movement is in the results. This is why we need to have a little bit of information. I'll tell you a good resource for that. But we need to have some information on this. By the way, again, he can be a little crass. I can't always recommend it, but there's a guy named Stephen Crowder. And he has a lot of videos on this topic. If you type in Stephen Crowder transgenderism, a lot of great videos with a lot of great information. Really, really important information on this. But the proof is in the results. We see suicidality. We see people who are miserable. We see the degradation of society around us. We have to embrace maleness and femaleness. Men should be manly. Women should be feminine. Now, is there such a thing as a more masculine woman and a more feminine male? Yes. And we don't sit there and say, well, you know, you need to change everything about you, but you need to find a proper balance. You need to find a proper balance where you still embrace being a man, even if you have more feminine attributes. Not a big deal. So there is a spectrum that we could talk about, but that doesn't change the fact that you either are a man or you are a woman. And there are certain things about that that we just need to live, whether you fully feel it or not. Whether you feel it or not, we should need to live those things. We need to recognize that when you talk to people who are in this movement, as aggressive as they may seem, it's the same thing with the homosexuality stuff that I talked about before. They're aggressive because they're hiding an inner pain and a misery. They are miserable. How do we react when using pronouns? This is kind of an important topic. You'll say, well, if this guy wants to be called her and she, should you do it? Here's my response to this. Don't be a jerk. Don't sit there and intentionally call them the pronoun they don't want to be called to their face. But when it's not to their face, or when you're talking with them privately and quietly, or, you know, if you can do it the right way, then by all means, I still call Bruce Jenner Bruce Jenner. So we don't push against it just to be a jerk. If it's not going to make a good point, if it's just going to create a fight, there's probably not the best time to do it. But we do need to insist that a man is a man and a woman is a woman, period. By the way, the CDC, we're supposed to all follow the CDC on just about everything right now, right? Because of coronavirus, and we're just supposed to trust them in everything. They had regulations for new mothers, but they don't say women who are pregnant. It says people who are pregnant. Because you can no longer say that only women can get pregnant. You're not allowed to say that anymore. That's how crazy this is. CDC, I'm going to listen to them. And then it says that they should try to stay as much as possible 6 feet away from their child if they're not nursing or something. Yeah. This, I told you I was going to end with some really important stuff. When we talk about this stuff, we can't just be all against. I don't mean we're going to embrace part of this, but rather that our message has to be positive. We need to have a positive message, which means a positive message about true life and true fulfillment. You are so much more than your desires. This is part of our message. We need to tell people that. You are so much more than your desires. And it's possible to have distorted and broken desires. It's absolutely possible. It happens all the time. So how you feel is not the most important thing, because you feel different things at different times. If we lived our whole lives based on how we feel, well, then guess what? There are some days where I feel like being my kid's dad, and there are some days where I feel like taking my arsenal and going to the shooting range and ignoring my wife and kids for the next 5 hours. But I don't do that, because how I feel is not the most important thing. Some days when I feel like sleeping in and not saying my prayers, that's not the way to live. So here's the key to all this. When we have these discussions, we need to be able and willing and bold in sharing not just our opinions about these things, but our worldviews. We need to be able to share what orthodoxy is and why we find fulfillment in this more than anything, and how this will help you in your struggles. I told you that I wrote a little booklet. I'm still having some people look over it and everything, but I wrote a book that talks about this. What is orthodoxy? And it's a spiritual, like, what is the purpose of the church? What does this really mean for us? A couple of you have read it already. I've gotten some good feedback. We need to be able to do that. We need to be able to share our true worldview.
Another guy makes the point that you can read that and do what you wrote if you know it, but you would just want to know authenticity if you're doing the very same thing they're doing.
Yep.
In other words, you might have a different setup. I mean, you might have the right mindset and the right worldview, but if we are living according to our feelings, then it's going to be hollow. Right? If you're just a heterosexual hedonist and you don't fast and you don't fight against everything, you have no position. And it's not about, it's in your spirit. Like holy people can disarm anybody because they're living not according to their passion. So it's part and parcel of the knowledge of what Paul's talking about, is that if we're not living orthodoxy, living Christianity and doing it, then people just know it. And they won't even listen to what we say.
Yeah, people are really good at zooming in on hypocrisy. We talked about this in lecture 2. Remember we talked about it? If you're not living the Orthodox life, but you're fighting for it, what are you? An Orthodox ideologue. You can't be an Orthodox ideologue. You actually have to live it. It has to be orthodoxy of the heart. And that's the most convincing argument we have. You've heard me say that, I think, multiple times. I can't remember if in the lectures themselves or the answers to the questions at the end, but we've said it many, many times. Orthodoxy of the heart is what people really need to see. So that even if you don't have the verbal argument ready to go, people see the life, and they see the peace, and they see the humility, and they see the love. And they say, whatever that is, I want it. Where can I get that? We need to be ready with both, which means we really need to be living this. And again, holiness is, in a way, addictive. The more we seek a holy life in our own homes, the more that transforms the world around us. We need that. So, there were just a couple other comments I was going to make about this push with children today, just you know how much to be aware of this stuff. So I'm just going to mention a couple things really quickly, and then we'll end. First of all, you may have seen this big controversy about this movie out on Netflix. You seen this? The movie's called Cuties, and it's about 11-year-olds who go and do this very sexualized dancing and stuff. And the interesting thing is the movie itself is actually not trying to promote that stuff. I haven't watched it, but I've read a summary of the movie, and essentially it's actually pushing against this idea of an over-sexualized culture where these children have nowhere to go. They feel like home life isn't fulfilling, and so they go and they find this stuff online, they try to live it. So the underlying message of the movie may be good. The problem is that the question is, okay, if this is your message, how far do we want to go in showing the bad stuff in order to push the message? I think the movie goes way too far. It's really disgusting, but it's not, the movie itself is not what I want to talk about. What I want to tell you about is the way Netflix advertised the movie. If you look at, this is a French movie, if you look at the French poster, it's this shot behind of these girls basically after having shopping, I think they were shopping, and they're like running down the street together and skipping down the street, and they have all their bags and everything, and that's it. But Netflix decided for an American audience, we would show these hyper-sexualized images of these 11-year-olds dancing in skimpy outfits. They advertised it thinking this is going to be a good way for people to want to subscribe to our business and watch this movie. That's what they thought. Now, when there was an outcry, they said, oops, we made a mistake. But there's a push. And to prove that there's a push, I want to tell you about I won't tell you who it was, but there's somebody who posted on their Twitter. They posted a picture of themselves in front of what's called the transgender pride flag. And their post said this. I won't say the word, obviously. F it. I have nothing to lose. MAP pride. Remember MAP? Minor attracted person. MAP pride. Hashtag MAP. Hashtag MAP rights. Hashtag MAP pride. Hashtag MAP acceptance. Hashtag trans. Hashtag come at me. Oh, I'm sorry. Come at me anti. If you disagree, you're suddenly anti. That's what it really is. Hashtag FML. I won't tell you what that means. Pride. So this is not... Remember, it was just like a month ago that it was, we have minor attraction and we can't help it. We can't help it. We just want you to understand that. And now it's, no. I'm actually proud of the fact that I have minor attraction. Sexual attraction. Pride. I'm proud of that. And you should accept me in my pride. The world is going nuts. It's going nuts. So this is actually the exact point that Father Justin was making that I wanted to end with. And that's that we need to embrace Christ more than ever. Because again, deep down, these people who are doing really evil things are miserable. And they need good examples of solid faith. They need good examples of people who have peace, who have humility, who have love. We need to get to work. This is the world we live in. It's getting worse. It's not getting better. We're not going to shift the culture anytime soon. But we can shift our own hearts. And we can make them beacons. And that's what we need to be, both individually and as a parish. We need to be beacons so that people can walk in and say, I really want this. So forgive me for going over. Again, there's a lot more we could have talked about. But
what you said is, on a real practical basis, it means knowing this stuff, what Brother Paul said, being able to explain it, having a conversation. But it doesn't just, when he says the heart doesn't mean what God has described for these Orthodox values of the church, but it means it's a fight to have. So in other words, we often think it's only the external things that people see in me that's what matters. So I have my argument, and it looks like I'm living an Orthodox life. The funny thing is, spiritually, that doesn't seem to matter, actually. It's like I've learned with the Father and the Son, for instance. If the Father is struggling with inappropriate things sexually, it's almost a guarantee that when I get a confession to the Son, of course, there's no anything about that, that he also begins to struggle at a certain age. And there's also a mystical connection that when the Father overcomes it, or is a pure person, that also mystically is connected to the Son as well. And so that's what people don't know about that in the spiritual life. So you can be as critical as you want of people who are suffering with sexual confusion and things, but if you're watching pornography and masturbating, you have no place to say a darn thing because you're doing the same thing in many ways. In other words, okay, many of you say it's not as bad as this, but the whole point of the Christian life is to crucify your desires. And to go, don't just go with your feelings. I think a lot of us Christians, they think they're so traditional, they can stand up against this stuff, but they don't fight against their desires at all. Right? They don't care what they eat, what they drink, what they do, whatever. But they think it's pretty commonly accepted, it's kind of traditional, and no wonder their words are going to have zero effect. Because if you look more mentally, mystically, they can sense that this is, why would they be drawn to that? You're no different, you're a hypocrite. Right? So, I mean, Father Paul said nicely, maybe I said more bluntly, like, if we don't really uproot our passions, we're going to be in a really terrible place on our own, regardless of the people. And also, we'll have no ability to share anything. So, learning this stuff you're saying is hard enough, but the real work is talking about.
Yeah, and this goes back to that idea. We've talked about this before, maybe not in this series, but you are not your thoughts. Well, guess what? You're also not your desires, you're not your feelings. But if you're identifying with those anyway, then you're not really identifying. When you call yourself a Christian, that's a powerful thing. You're saying, I identify by my relationship with Christ more than anything. Can we really say that about our lives? If we can, it means we're really fighting against those false desires and false passions and false feelings. But that means an active life. So just before I forget, because I keep forgetting to do this on the recordings, the two books that I really recommend, both by Ryan Anderson. He's done a fabulous job on both these. The first one that I mentioned was Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom. And then the second one has to do with transgenderism. He wrote a phenomenal book. A few of you have read it. A phenomenal book on transgenderism. I didn't like the title at first because I thought it sounded very polemical. But I read it. I actually have read it twice now. It is so great. And it's called When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. Believe it or not, things get outdated very, very quickly with this movement, and some things maybe help to do an updated version, but 99.9% of it is still very, very, in fact, it's all really relevant still. So When Harry Became Sally, it's a really, really great one, both by Ryan T. Anderson. So thank you.